her was last year. It was at a conference, and she went up, and she was talking about Grapevine, and I don't, the way she spoke and the way she carries herself just drew me to her. She's about service work. She's kind. She's funny. She's witty and beautiful. So I can't wait to come up for her to come up here and share her story with us. And it's Karen M.
Karen.
And then I never look at them. But today I might actually follow a little bit of the script, but maybe not. First off, I want to thank Connie. She is such a beautiful person. She's as beautiful inside as she is out, no doubt about it. And I just congratulations on your chairing this event for this particular month, and I'm sorry you chose me to kick it off. I love speaker meetings, especially when I'm not speaking. Now, the last time I was here and spoke, it was the weekend where you have an AA and an Al-Anon. The Al-Anons invited me. Okay, so I'm very popular in the fellowship. Just like that. My name is Karen Mitchell, and I am a grateful alcoholic. And by the grace of a God that I do not understand, good sponsorship, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to take a drink since November 20th, 2009. Should have happened a lot longer ago than that. But as you can tell by my attractive, very silver hair. I got sober at a later age in life. As a matter of fact, I was 54, so my drunk log could go on for a while. But I hate that. I'm going to try to keep it a little shorter and talk about what life is like today. I was here last week to listen to Art. I mean, 50 years, come on, give me a break, you know? And there was a lot of announcements and stuff, and you know, I timed it, and he had 45 minutes, and now I got a little extra. That's not fair. Anyway, I love speaker meetings, like I said. I can start off with, I love it. I wish I could say, I was born an only child and I wasn't a favorite.
That's funny.
However, someone already used that, and it's not my story, so I can't lie about that. Actually, I was born the oldest of two children, and I definitely was not the favorite. My mother was the oldest of three girls, and my brother, the younger, is a little boy, so she was fascinated with that. So he was her boy toy. And like I said, I was the oldest, and they had some expectations of me, but not so much. My mother was a little German girl. She was a farmer's daughter out in Siblo, and she married my dad, who was in basic training in at Randolph. And it was a big deal, you know, for little German girls to marry a flyboy and go away. So that's what she did. My father was from Alabama and very much struggled with authority, so he never rose in the rank. And a lot of that I know now is because he was an alcoholic. Imagine that. He couldn't take orders. And you'll see that my story kind of relates to that also. We got stationed over in Germany when I was about to start first grade. So first, second, and third grade in Europe. There wasn't English-speaking TV there. We had TV, but it was in a language that wasn't known to me. My mother never spoke German to us, unfortunately. So we relied on the radio. Armed Forces Network was loud and strong, and that was our entertainment. We listened to all the old classics like The Lone Ranger and Amos and Andy, and Jim shaking his head, he remembers these days. The Shadow, remember The Shadow? Yeah, okay. So anyway, radio is known as the theater of the mind, and that was my entertainment. And it also helped me in the way to escape, because when my father got really drunk, he would come home and he would be very abusive to my mother. And I guess I was probably in second grade when my mother set up a cot in my bedroom. And that was just kind of the way it was. And I knew something was very wrong with that whole picture. But all I knew was I didn't feel safe. And when we got transferred back to the States, my mother did find the courage to leave my father. So they divorced pretty much when we hit stateside. And it wasn't terribly long after that that she remarried a man that apparently she'd been dating in Germany. Well, anyway, that same year that she remarried my stepfather, my dog got run over by a car. My rabbit, Snowball, ran away. My mother married a guy who I didn't know that well. To top it all off, the stress of life itself kind of sped up my biological clock. So Mother Nature came to call at 10 years old. Well, my mother understood all about that cramping thing. And the only thing she knew to do to help me alleviate that was a hot toddy. Oh, yeah. Now, for you, those of you that don't know what a hot toddy is, it's basically liquor warmed up. With a slice of lemon on it, it wasn't legal, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, it did not only alleviate the physical pain, it pretty much got me drunk. And I really enjoyed that first experience of that warm liquid going down, that soothing feeling, and I knew that I wanted to experience that again someday, sooner than later, preferably. Now, again, even stateside, the transistor radio was my friend, and I was one of those little kids who always had the transistor, you know, that now we call them earbuds, I don't know what the heck we called them back then, but anyway, it was always hanging from my ear when I went to bedside. The transistor was under my pillow, and I listened to the all-night disc jockey, and that was my only form of real intimacy that I understood. And so when I was 13, I made the stunning announcement to my mother that I was going to be a disc jockey. And she said, well, what do they do? And I kind of had an idea of what they did, and she said, well, you don't drop the typing class, because if that radio thing doesn't turn out, you can always be the secretary. She had a lot of faith in me. So, I didn't drop the typing class, and I'm glad I didn't. But anyway, I also was very involved in band, which kind of could give me some routine, some regimen, not only physically, but mentally. But I decided that spinning records was a whole lot easier than competing with a bunch of flautists. So I took the easier, softer way even at that point. Now, talking into a microphone in a sound booth was my first venture into anonymity. Funny how that works, okay? You might know my voice, but you never knew my face, and I always said I had a face made for radio. My guy definitely has a sense of humor. So I went off to college. I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to be in broadcasting, so that was a foregone conclusion. So I moved back to Lubbock. I had done a lot of growing up in Lubbock, and moved from San Antonio back to Lubbock and went to Texas Tech. And when... Whoa! I did the final four. Did you see that? Just say it. Anyway, I knew nothing about sports, so that's just, you know, all for show. I don't know. Anyway, I worked my way through. I got my license. Back then, you had to have a license to be on the radio. Imagine that. Now, anymore, I can talk on the radio. Anyway, I had to have a license. The FCC licensed me. I had to get a waiver. I didn't pass it the first time, so I took it a second time. About 19 years of age, I was on the radio. I worked my way through college as a disc jockey in a kind of an underground radio station.
All right.
And when I was 20, when I was a junior in college, I got married. And the story is that I found a guy whose last name was indigenous to radio. So I married a guy named John Watts. So then I became known on the air as Karen 100,000 watts. Okay, now understand, this was in the mid-70s, so the term sex, drugs, rock and roll wasn't just a cliche for me, it was my life. I got to either interview or co-MC, introduce, hang out with some of the well-known artists of that particular era, like Aria Speedwagon, Aerosmith, Earth, Wind, and Fire, I remember playing with to some degree. We even loaded up, and Tom Petty when he was brand new. I mean, this kid, they had him so drugged out, trying to get him on a microphone to interview him was a bit of a challenge. And Harry Chapin, meeting him and having him sing on stage, I am the all-night DJ, and used my name, I was so excited. Anyway, my ego really needed that one, right? Anyway, we even loaded up the Cat Van. I worked for a station in Oklahoma City called the Cat FM. And we loaded up the hippie van, and we traveled across the state of Texas at a Bruce Springsteen tour. Yeah, I got to party with the boss. So anyway, radio took me to Dallas, and I transitioned into sales. Well, okay, I'm an alcoholic, so I'm a natural born BSer. By the time in mid-80s in Dallas, Texas, in selling radio advertising, I was making a boatload of money for a 25-year-old. I mean, a boatload of money. Now, I can't tell you where any of them went. Probably don't want to know where they all went. But anyway, it was fun, and it was Party City. I mean, it was big-time Party City. Now, at one point while I was in Dallas, I had a couple of gals, clients, who were very married and not real happy about that whole status of their life. And they decided I, as their rep, needed to take them to the Bear in Fort Worth, which is a male strip club, on my expense account, which I was reluctant to accommodate a little. So anyway, I took him to Le Bear, and apparently we had a good time. And the next thing I remember, I'm in the Euless or Bedford, one of those mid-cities between Dallas and Fort Worth. I was in the jail. And they only got me for public intoxication because I was dressed so nice and I acted so nice to the officer. Grace of God, did it for me what I couldn't do for myself. But that was pretty much my first indication that alcohol might be an issue in my life. So I did spend the night at Grey Bar and Motel. And friends of my husband at that time said, you know, I think she might have a problem. And he said, no, we just like to party. So that's the way that went. Pretty amazing how all that happened. I moved back to San Antonio. Radio took me back to San Antonio, and my husband, the Watts part of my name, we split the sheets, as it were, and I was in radio here in San Antonio, still. And so it was a geographic, basically, and my drinking had really escalated to a really pretty serious thing at that time. And so I did my geographic, and the thing I always loved about that is no matter where I go, there I am. And nothing had really changed a whole lot, but my career was still not dead, although it was waning. And I did get another public intoxication charge, just simply because I wasn't driving, but I deserved it, no doubt about it. So my promiscuous and somewhat wily lifestyle continued, and then God had another little plan for me. At the age of 37, I got pregnant. And it was unintentional, I guarantee you. Now, I knew what got me there, but it wasn't intentional. I became a Murphy Brown of San Antonio. And a friend of mine was the news director at Channel 5, so they did a story on me, which was really kind of weird. Anyway, but I got to tell you, God blessed me with a baby girl. I did not drink during my pregnancy, and I did not drink for 8 months after. But she probably saved my life. At least it put drinking off for a little while, so I wasn't going to get sicker or die. But as soon as I stopped nursing, my doctor basically gave me permission to drink. So I did, and I was back off to the races like I'd never missed a beat. Now, when my daughter, I did not marry the man who fathered my daughter. He was an unwilling participant. When I told him I was pregnant, he said, "Get rid of it." And I said, "I have a better idea. I'll get rid of you."
There you go.
And keep the baby. I had the means. I had the support. I had my parents' support. And so I kept the baby. But when she was about 2 years old, her father decided, and I had him sign papers, and he basically waived his rights as a parent. When she was about 2 years old, he really gave me a big push, and he wanted to be a part of her life. And a friend of mine who had also been a single mom was dealing with her son asking the questions, "Who's my dad? How come I don't know anything about him?" etc. And she said, "You're being very selfish, not letting her know her father." And I thought, she has a good point. So basically, for her, I consented to marry him when she was 2 years old. It's the biggest mistake of my life. But I didn't know that at the time. I still had lessons to learn. When Casey was about seven, he did something so socially unacceptable that in order not to drag us down, he decided to go up to our Blanco property and put a bullet in his brain. So I was left with a seven-year-old, no father, a house I couldn't afford. I found out he did not renew his life insurance, which he was supposed to. And because of the incident, which was somewhat public, I lost my job. I lost a circle of friends. I lost everything, basically. The life as I knew it ceased to exist. And that was basically an excuse for me to drink even more. And it got really pretty bad. I remember sitting in the other bedroom looking on the streets wondering if they were going to come take me away, if they were going to repossess the house, what exactly was going to happen next. And shortly after, my spouse killed himself. You know, people, when they go to funerals and they approach you, they don't know what to say. You know, it's like, "I'm there for you," and me as the grieving widow, you're going, "Yeah, right." And I had my pride, and I didn't want anybody infringing on my drinking. But there was one man who had been a friend of mine in the media circuit who told me, he said, "I want you to put your honey-do list together, and I'm going to come up and do the things that you can't do. Like start the vehicles and clean the pool and fix the door locks and, you know, things like that that I really didn't have the wherewithal to do." And I said, no, you don't have to do that." But he was pretty insistent. He said, "I'm going to come anyway, whether you have your honey-do list together or not." So he showed up one Saturday, and he fixed all the things that I couldn't do. And he said, "And I'll be back next week." And I said, "You don't have to do that." And he goes, "Yes, I do." And he kept coming back. Like a bad penny. However, it was a very good thing. It was a very good thing for me. Our friendship grew into something more. And as a good friend told us, said, "I know this is getting serious, but give it four seasons and give your daughter four seasons to get used to this relationship." Because it was pretty quick after her dad had died. And so we gave it the four seasons, and he kind of grew on her. And with her blessing, we got married. And in February, we celebrated 18 years. He was also my drinking buddy that I built with. This was probably the first time I'd loved anyone besides my daughter in a very, very long time. It was a loveless relationship I'd had with her father. So Al and I, we now refer to him affectionately as Al-Anon Al. we eventually bought a direct mail franchise business, and we did fairly well. You know, we stayed sober enough to knock out a few sales, and, you know, we actually got an award nationally, and You know, we were kind of humming along, and then 08 happened. And while our customers were small business owners, and they were folding up and dropping like flies, he and I were determined we were going to make this thing work. As we were sitting there with our glass of wine and bottle of vodka and whatever else we could conjure up. And finally, it actually went until later, we closed the business. But in the meantime, I ceased to be productive at all. I ceased to be productive. I did all the things I said I would never, ever do. I got up especially early every morning so I could hit the vodka bottle. I was hitting it really hard. I said, oh, that's just to make sure I wasn't shaken enough that I could sign a check. And half the time, I couldn't sign a check. I was showing up at school functions with a serious buzz, if not totally drunk. I showed up at a football game once that was so drunk they had to haul me out. I was a total embarrassment to my daughter, to my family. I showed up at Chamber of Commerce events with a serious buzz. I went to band concerts with a serious buzz. I may not have embarrassed myself, but I was not present. So at the ripe old age of 54, my evolution of prayer started. I went into the bathroom and I was just miserable. I was sick. I was sick every single day. There was not one day that I did not throw up. And that gets a little old. Just saying. Just really old. Really fast. At 54, I got down on my knees in the bathroom. And while I was praying to the porcelain God, I prayed to a God I did not understand. And I said, please help. And by the grace of God, I managed to find out from an associate pastor, with the help of my not then now husband, where I could go to get treatment. Now, I didn't have insurance. We were self-employed. So a lot of reason why I put all this off, because I knew it was coming, was because I had to pay out of pocket, and I knew it was going to cost a fortune. But I decided it was probably worth it. Probably worth it for my daughter to grow up to have a mother. Probably worth it to be able to see her walk across the stage from high school graduation sober. And I just thought, this is something I need to do, and I need to do it for me. So I finally had the right reason down. And I checked into a little rehab center up in Center Point, Texas. Is anybody in the room from Starlight?
Yeah!
Anyway, it was the place I needed to be at that time. And guess what? $16,000 later, I got me a big book.
That's a big book.
That was not my party gift. And I was screaming in there like a very, very desperate woman and said, fix me and fix me now. And that poor counselor, I just absolutely wore her out. They brought her out of retirement to see me. They did. Because they were overbooked. It was like the fullest attendance they had there. Everybody wanted to get sober. It was right before Christmas. Right? It was November the 20th. And I thought, well, that's crazy. Why would people want to get sober right before the holidays? My husband doesn't push her back. Why would you want to get sober right before the holidays? And I said, exactly that? I am tired of embarrassing myself and not remembering what I got for Christmas. Or what I'm getting for Christmas. So it was a 30-day program, as some of you know. And they told me that they were only going to get me 3 or 5 steps. And I went, my God, I paid $16,000. I want all 12. I'm here to get sober. And hopefully stay that way. The money was writing on me. The texts were going, she's going to last. You know, 1 to 3% that come out of rehab are expected to stay sober? I wanted to be a 1%. Okay, I've always been a bit of an overachiever anyway. That was going to have to work. And they said, well, let's just get it through 5, okay? And they taught me so much in there. They taught me not only the steps, but they taught me about God. And there's a little chapel. You know, the little chapel on the grounds there, turning up there at Starlight. Brother Leroy used to come deliver a message to us on Sunday mornings.
I'm still there.
I know, isn't that great? And then I attended meetings here at 7 o'clock with him much later. but I found God in that chapel. I did my fifth step, which is probably a paid fifth step person. I don't know. I don't care. But it was a spiritual experience. I didn't know what a spiritual experience was until that. She was a beautiful woman, and I just wanted to put her in my pocket and take her home. She was it, man. And they said, no, you're going to find a sponsor when you get to your home group. And I didn't know what that was all about. So I also became, since I was more mature, I became basically the den mother of the female ward, if you will. The whole wing of female, not a prima. And I was the greeter. As soon as they brought one in, dropped them off, truck, I would be the one going, okay, you okay? Okay. So my maternal instincts were alive and well, and they utilized them too. There was one lady that was my age, and she turned out to be a cougar. They booted her out. I could not understand what that old woman was doing crawling in and out of those little boys' rooms. I have to explain it to them. 13 stepping is alive and well right here. Also, this woman, there was a group of us old farts there. There were about four of us, I guess, and we hung out. We always sit on the back row until the director, the clinical director, said, you know, we call that relapse room. So before it was all said and done, we had worked our way from the third row to the second row, and now I was on the first row before it all ended. I mean, I was there. I was there. So I did my 30 days, and they were ready to cut me loose. And I went, oh, no, the real world. I don't know that I can face that. It was my sanctuary. But they kicked me out, put me in the hands of my now Al-Anon husband. He was firmly ensconced in the arms of Al-Anon. Apparently, my second week in rehab, he went screaming into an Al-Anon room and said, help! After about four glasses of wine. So anyway, they had asked me, though, how do you feel about alcohol in your house when you get home? And I said, you have to tell him. So I told him, I said, if you would please, please not have any alcohol in the house. You can have it in your beer fridge outside, but please, just for a while until I get used to this sober thing, please no alcohol in the house. Well, I'm happy to report he hasn't had a drop since.
Wow. Wow.
He drank everything in the house. And he used my credit card to buy a few more things before I got home. But it was clean when I got there. So that was a very good thing. But when I got out, you know, they said you need to get to a meeting like pretty quick, right? So he already had one picked out for me. He already had a sponsor picked out for me. Yeah, for sure. He's an overachiever too, did I mention that? So he pointed me in the direction of the Spring Branch group up in Spring Branch, if you all know that. That's just north of San Antonio. And it's not a very big group, but it's a very intimate group, and they had a meeting that Sunday, and I fell in love. I felt safe, and I thought, man, this is it. A lady who kind of looked like Cruella DeVille swooped down on me and said, my first, like my second day maybe, and she said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And she scared the crap out of me. she was from New York. She was Jewish. She was tall. She was skinny. And she was very, very liberal, totally nothing like me. She was beautiful, though. She taught me so much. She taught me about AA etiquette, about going to meetings, about keeping your mouth shut, and about not spewing your disease, but sharing your recovery. She taught me all sorts of things. And then she cut me off because she said, Karen, I have to get into this service thing. And I'm involved in this thing that's called an international. So now this is 2010. And you know what? You guys threw me a dadgum party. I was 8 months sober, and you've invited people from all over the world. And we had this party downtown San Antonio, and you gave me a t-shirt, and it said volunteer. I have never, ever had a spiritual experience that would probably equal, in a very special way, what it was like to hold hands with 54,000 alcoholics from around the world in St. Petersburg. There's nothing like it. And that kind of got me into thinking that there might be a life beyond Spring Branch. So my sponsor did kind of kick me out of the nest and say, you need to find out how these other people do this thing. So I ventured out. It was hard. It was hard to get out of my home group, but I needed to know you people, because I felt like you had something I wanted. Everyone has something I want. So I went out there and I did that. But before I left Spring Branch, they decided, I was really blessed in the regard that there were some great old timers in that group. Don Clark, I don't know if any of you remember him. Garland came to that meeting every morning. I got to hear his wisdom and strength and hope, and what a beautiful person he was. But Don C. decided I was going to get bored real fast, so he got me real busy. So after about 6-7 months of sobriety, I guess, he made me the CSOR. And that's where I met Lefty. And I got a whole new sense of AA and what it was all about, to serve the alcoholic who still suffers. And I realized, oh my God, that's the fifth tradition. That's what we're all about, and that's 12 step. So I got involved in service at that point. I became the alternate GSR because I thought I heard, that all you have to do is pray that the GSR doesn't die or drink. So that's an easy gig. I cut my teeth on that. And within the first month, the GSR stepped down and I automatically became the GSR Spring Branch group. And I also, at that point, became the treatment facility chair for District 2. Unbeknownst to me, there are no inpatient treatment facilities in District 2. So I decided that catering to our elder population, because it is a mecca for retirement communities / nursing / assisted living homes. And so I found out what I could about that. It's a huge movement, guys. It's not quite as big as the young people's, but that's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got involved there. I found my way to Turning Point Group on Saturday mornings, and my current sponsor, I think she had something going on there. She decided that I should probably stand for their alternate GSR, because they had not been real active in the service arena, and the history repeats itself. I became a GSR. So I'm a glutton for punishment. If you want to be a GSR, it's a thankless job, but you'll learn a lot. Number one, how to be humble, and you are not in charge. You are not in charge. I learned that very succinctly. I also, ultimately, I was relatively new in sobriety, and I got real involved in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was kind of like when I got pregnant with my daughter. My father had passed away at 10, and I had lost connection with his family, so I didn't know the DNA part, right? And when I got into AA, I wanted to know its DNA, its structure. Who were the parents? How did this thing happen? What is this thing we call Alcoholics Anonymous that's been around 84 years, June 10, people? 84. Next year will be 85. Woo-hoo. But I wanted to know how this all worked. So I read a lot. I read beyond the big book and the 12 and 12. I read AA Comes of Age. I read Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I'm a huge fan of Dr. Bob. I mean, let's think about it. Bill and Bob. Bill was a promoter. If he'd had his way, we'd be franchised like McDonald's. He was a promoter. Dr. Bob was the more spiritual, quiet one who kind of softened everything and made us what we are today. But I was a big fan of Dr. Bob's. I read Language of the Heart. I got a Grapevine subscription when I was fresh out of rehab. Who does that? I was in. Somebody told me, my first sponsor said, if you're coming to AA, come in, sit down, and don't leave. And I believed her. I came in, I sat down, and I wanted to be a part of you. I can't say I was a part of too much growing up, but I felt you were where I needed to be. And in order to keep this gift that I was given, I needed to pass it on. So I was very ensconced in that, in the service work of carrying the message in the service structure. I was relatively new to all of this when my now sponsor asked me to be part of a panel on a workshop on why study the history of AA. And I went, well, okay, fine. I was talking, and I'm saying no. So as we get closer to the date, I decided to ask, well, who else is on the panel? And she said, well, Bobby J. and a gentleman known as Jim Willis. That's a little intimidating for someone with 2 years sober. And I went, oh my gosh, these guys are the history of AA. I will be a fight. I don't know. I'm literally squat compared to these guys. So my intimidation factor was like off the charts, and I was, you know, what am I going to say? And my sponsor said, what do you know about early women in sobriety? And I said, well, you know, other than the big book stories, not a whole lot. And she said, find out everything you can about that and make that your area of expertise. And I went, oh my gosh. So I read all about Mrs. Marty Mann. I read about, now, she's not in sobriety, but she contributed a lot to our story of Sister Ignatia. She has a great story. And I read about early women in recovery, and I went, this is so awesome. So I knew these were my people for sure. Marty Mann I related to from the get-go. I mean, she said that she could drink anyone under the table, any man under the table, and she had a hollow leg. I grew up with those phrases, man. She would tell my story, you know. She was an amazing woman, and what she's done for us today, many of us don't even realize. But she's responsible for it being insured and AMA recognizing it as a disease and all the other things that we have here. But she was an amazing woman. She's one of my heroes, and that to me is something we can't have enough of. We need heroes. Not only in life outside of AA, but in AA. We need people we can look up to, like these gentlemen on the front row. Hello. I was at an Alzheimer's meeting recently, and one of the speakers there said, if you have to ask what the big deal is about Alzheimer's, don't worry about it. You'll never be one. That struck me. So onward into the service arena, I became a DCM. And I think the last time I spoke here, I was a DCM, and they asked me what my home group was, and I said District 17. because I consider them all home group people. I mean, I feel at home anywhere I go. I can walk into the 7 o'clock here, I can walk into the 11 o'clock, I can walk in anywhere and feel at home. And that's something I didn't have the luxury of for many, many years. I was not comfortable in my own skin. I was either who you wanted me to be or who my imagination thought I was. And the program taught me how. Honesty, openness, and willingness. And that's what I have today. So I also got some really cool opportunities. I got to be, and I don't recommend this to anybody, it's not for the faint of heart. I was hospitality chair of the state convention in 2017. You try feeding 1,500 alcoholics. Not a pretty picture. But it was a privilege to get to meet people from all over the state who make that their pilgrimage. It's like a religion. And it was awesome. It was awesome. It was stressful, but it was awesome. And then shortly after that, we had this little thing called a regional forum, whereby our wonderful servants in New York that facilitate this world's largest not-for-profit organization, where they come here and they facilitate a workshop. Actually, it's a forum where you get to say what you want to say, because we are the heartbeat of AA. They don't dictate to us. We dictate to them. We're the most important thing in that upside-down pyramid. You are the most important thing. They come here to hear your voice. What an amazing concept that was. Unbeknownst to me, I was also in charge of all the volunteers for that event, and I got to chauffeur the general manager there in New York. His name is Mr. Tobin. And we were sharing some notes. He's an author. He's a published author. And I said, one of my favorite authors from your part of the world. And he said, and who might that be? And I think I know. And I said, no, you couldn't know. And he goes, well, who is it? And I said, Nelson DeMille. And he goes, I got to meet him. And I went, oh my God, can I touch you? But he was just a wonderful human being. It was so great to be with all those people that whole weekend. And the actual, the head of the board, the chairperson, she sent me a thank you note after it was all over, a handwritten thank you note, and said, thank you for your hospitality in San Antonio. It was so great to get to know you. Who does that? How did she find my home address is what I want to know. We have babies, believe me. So, about a year and a half ago, a little over a year and a half ago, my stepfather, who my mother had been seeing before she became my stepmother, I don't have any resentment about that anymore. They were married for 52 years. And he very suddenly passed away. So, finally, my mother and I, who were never close, but God made sure that that incident, after 52 years of them being married, that she and I got to be close again. That's a gift. That's a gift you don't get every day. She and I actually share, of course, we share our grief with his loss, his passing, but also we commiserate with my daughter, who is out there. She's not an alcoholic, and I, as far as I know, she's not a drug addict, but she has some serious mental issues as a result of things that her father did. And I'd like you to keep her in your prayers. One day she will be back, and God willing, I'll still be sober and able to help her in the way that I was helped. But that chapter of my life is yet to be written, and I'm open and willing to whatever God has in store. Something that I read was a book called Why Bad Things Happens to Good People, Why Bad Things Happen. And something I learned in that is sometimes God has to do bad things, make bad things happen for us to get closer to Him. And I have to look at it that way. But my prayer life evolved from the help, and I ripped this off from Anne Lamont, by the way, if it sounds familiar, went from help to thanks, to now I'm in the wow stage. Wow. I mean, this fellowship has a wow factor that you have to experience. And I'm hoping that some of you are in that phase. I never know what the day's going to hold. I basically start my prayer life with, I'm available today. I don't know what's in store. And I introduce myself that I got sober by the grace of God. I don't understand. I don't want to understand Him because that would limit His power and His capability. It would only be related to my finite thinking and not His infinite wisdom. So I try to keep myself open to that. By the time it was all said and done for the all the things that were available for me to do in service opportunity, Connie mentioned something about Grapevine, and I mentioned that I got a Grapevine subscription when I first got sober. Well, guess what? I'm your Grapevine chair for San Antonio.
All right.
And I love spreading that word. I mean, Grapevine's going to be 75 years old this June. 75. That sweet lady Jen, who just read the traditions, had her story published. And she serves on my Grapevine committee, and I love her to death. But Grapevine is an awesome 12-step tool. In case you don't know about this, this is my little bit of pitch. But it's a great 12-step tool. You can also see only area of service that contributes to all the other service committees. You can take them into prisons. Treatment centers love them. Professionals leave one on your doctor's coffee table when you leave the room. Who knows? The next person who sits down there and has to wait an hour for the doctor might be an alcoholic and needs to hear the message. You never know. But that's how I carry the message today, not to mention in sharing through meetings. Sharing in meetings is important. Showing up. Suiting up and showing up. That's what I learned to do. I don't know what God has in store, but I got to suit up and show up. That's all I know. And in working the 12 steps, I've learned I still have some character defects. And those I'm working on every day. And I might have the solution or a way to make them a little less obvious from you. I hear something new in every single meeting I go to. But anyway, I think I've spoken long enough. And I just hope that one of you who ventured out into the rain, and there was a flood on 281, risked life and limb to get here. God put you here for a reason. And God let whatever message came out of my mouth, they brought it to you. And if you were that person that got something out of this, come give me a hug afterwards. We both could use it. Thank you for my support.